This week we head to Milan to tell you everything you need to know about the iconic Pirelli calendar. Plus, we speak with the editor of the upcoming Greek edition of Vogue and hear from a magazine that's part of the rising leftist movement in the United States. All that ahead this week on The Stack. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis with me, Tom Edwards. Coming up on the programme, we'll discuss the relaunch of Vogue Greece and head to New York to visit the office of political title Jacobin. But first, to Milan. Whether it hangs on your wall or balances on your desk, the calendar is normally one very much overlooked print product. Fitting, perhaps, that it took the makers of another often uncelebrated object, the car tyre, to glamorise the calendar. Always recruiting the top in their game from the worlds of fashion photography and beyond, Pirelli succeeded in creating a cult publication that always gets plenty of attention. Monocle's Rome correspondent boarded the Frecciarossa and went to Pirelli's Milan HQ to see the 2019 edition being revealed.
Four different women. One common goal, the pursuit and fulfillment of their dreams. A wealthy socialite living in solitude in a glass tower, high above the busy streets of New York.
It's really difficult when you're in a field where you as a black woman will not succeed, so of course I've had my doubts, but I've never given up on my dreams, so.
I am.
It's like I have to take off all my protection and just giving myself to him to be able to catch something real.
You're playing characters, and to be with Leticia was fun. We laughed a lot and she's beautiful.
She's looking inward to find some sort of inspiration for the day, I guess, and I think that that is how I feel a lot of the time when I'm alone and I'm on tour, so.
Those were the various voices of American ballerina Misty Copeland, French supermodel Leticia Casta with another ballet dancer, Ukrainian Sergei Polunin, and finally there was a voice of current IT girl and model sensation Gigi Hadid. Are we at a film premiere perhaps? Or maybe a New York gala? The red carpet has certainly been rolled out, and the stars are out too. But no, we are not in Hollywood. We are, in fact, at a calendar launch at the headquarters of a tyre manufacturer on the outskirts of Milan. This is, of course, no ordinary calendar. This is the Pirelli calendar. You might not give that printed yearly publication you pin on your wall much thought, that humble stocking filler at Christmas that might feature fluffy kittens, or perhaps something smuttier you might try not to look at when you pick up your car from the mechanics. Girly pics that feature curves that are as well oiled as your motor. Female nudity, very much so, but Pirelli likes to think of its calendar as far from smutty. From its inception in 1964, the Cal, as it's branded, has featured a veritable roll call of anybody who is anybody in the worlds of fashion photography and the entertainment industries beyond. Models from Crawford to Campbell and from Moss to Bunsen have adorned its pages. Now controversial photographers like Richardson and Testino, together with industry heroes like Leibovitz and Lindbergh, have all had their turn to shoot for Pirelli. Big names and a massive multi-million euro budget. But is there any connection between Pirelli's motor-related product and this all-star calendar? I asked Pirelli CEO Marco Tronchetti for a little clarification.
Could I just ask you, in this day and age, what you think still links a manufacturer of tyres to a beautifully shot, beautifully presented calendar? Why is that relevant and what it means for your brand?
Pirelli tyres are really a piece of art. And the photographers are making pieces of art. That's the only thing that is linking our tyres with the photos.
So, And what does it mean for your brand, particularly after all these years, many decades, having this wonderful product that everyone is anticipating every year? How does that relate to your sort of your vision of what Pirelli means today?
Pirelli is part of the society. So it's a company that has more than 140 years of story behind. And so being part of the society, art is part and culture are part of our life. And so calendar is art and part of our life.
This branding exercise is almost too simple to believe. By stamping the company name on one of the world's most coveted printed objects, Pirelli is year after year embellishing its reputation not as a maker of tyres, but as an iconic brand. Lucky recipients of the 2019 calendar, and it cannot be bought but has always been sent to an exclusive list of executives and high-profile company clients, can expect a huge volume of 40 beautifully printed photographs featuring four main female protagonists, some of whose voices we heard at the beginning. Having his photographs appear in over 100 covers of Vogue and having shot people and faces as diverse as Alfred Hitchcock and Steve Jobs, Albert Watson, the man in charge of the calendar this year, is certainly at a Pirelli point of his career. I pulled a very busy Watson aside for a bit more explanation.
The idea of Pirelli was always to do an elegant, artistic interpretation of a pinup. That was the idea in the past. And in this case here, because that had been done dozens of times in the past, and I said this many times, it just didn't seem the right thing to take a bunch of supermodels down to the beach and take their tops off, you know? It just didn't seem to be the right time to do that. And therefore, I thought it was more interesting to do a cinema approach, to do four short films that the stills came from. So that it was to do much more of a cinema approach, and that's where the formatting of 16:9 came from, that it was all shot that way, and that the way we presented it, like it was a video screen and so on. So therefore, the approach to this was more classic, mm-hmm. in that it was classic photography as opposed to, say, fashion pictures.
As Pirelli's 2019 photographer Albert Watson mentioned there, it is anything but an ordinary calendar that is being launched here in Milan. So how about some of those featured models? Rising star in the acting community, Julia Garner has wowed audiences with her gritty role in TV series Ozark. I sat down with her.
What's it like seeing the images now? Like, how does it compare to maybe when you see yourself in a film or TV show that you've done and you rewatch it? I don't know if you do that obsessively, but now you can study these pictures, you can look closely at them, you can put them up. I don't know. What's it like seeing yourself in these images?
Well, it's always weird to like see yourself in general, because it's in the end of the day, it's yourself, even though you're playing a different character. But, you know, I guess when I watch something like Ozark, I'm like, ugh, I look terrible.
You're sort of meant to look terrible in that.
Listen, if they're like, you're gonna wake up in the scene and you're gonna have like a full face of makeup and lipstick, I'm gonna be like, what are you talking about? Like, don't put under eye. I make sure to look terrible for that. So I'm just like, don't put any under. Give me bags. These are all beautiful, and it's weird to say these are all beautiful images, and they're me. Again, Albert is just, he has such a vision, and Albert has a real gift in knowing people's faces and knowing what light a person looks good in, because everybody looks good in a different kind of light.
Julia Garner, along with dancer Misty Copeland and models Leticia Casta and Gigi Hadid, is one of the four leading ladies cast by Albert Watson for the shoot. There are also three supporting men this year. One of them is celebrated Ukrainian ballet dancer Sergei Polunin. He told me how he, as a dancer, sees photography.
Well, pictures, especially pictures of actors, inspired me the most. It was just black and white portraits. And dance is something there on the moment and never repeats. And dancer's life is quite quick. You know, dancer's career is fast. It's there and it's not there. But pictures capture time. And I think for dance is very important, because it can be on the wall many years later, inspire people and give that energy even if it's for a moment, it still carries on the energy and it will inspire people.
With so much from the world of fashion and the performing arts all around this Pirelli launch, it's quite easy to forget the object that is at the very heart of all the hype, the calendar itself, something that, of course, has been crafted and designed. Photographer Albert Watson, in fact, trained as a graphic designer at London's Royal College of Art, something that came in handy with this project too, he told me.
I think when you have a fairly intensive education by very good teachers in graphic design at a young age, it almost tattoos on your brain a little bit of that information. And you're actually, in a good way, you're stuck with it for the rest of your life. I find myself, and a lot of times when I frame, because you understand everything a photographer does is in a rectangle. It may be a long rectangle, it may be a vertical rectangle, it may be square, but it's all rectangle. So the way that you compose and how you put the elements together within that square is what makes you as a photographer. So the graphic design aspect helped me. It sometimes made my pictures, according to fashion editors, a little bit strong.
So and
a
little bit heavy. Boldness and the graphic element.
Yeah, the pictures come across as being very, an editor once said to me, your pictures are so masculine. I was not sure if it was a condemnation or it was a compliment. But that's what stuck with me, because people think of my pictures now as being very graphic and very iconic. Mm-hmm. So yes, graphics had a big effect on what I do.
So a calendar that is much more than dates and months with naughty pictures. Pirelli's annual star-studded publication is a print product like no other. The 2019 edition has gone far and beyond, something to be flicked every month, and is certainly artistic. It is, however, a bizarrely traditional form of advertising, in which photographing attractive, famous women is order of play. An undeniable page-turner nonetheless, the Pirelli calendar allure, much like the tyres, should not wear out too soon. For Monocle, in Milan, I'm David Pleasant.
Staying in the world of fashion next on The Stack. Over the last year, Condé Nast, the publisher of Vogue, has taken the magazine to new markets, including Poland, the Czech Republic and Slovakia. Now it's revisiting some of its previous markets too. After a six-year hiatus, the Greek version of Vogue is relaunching, under the youngest ever editor to take the helm of any Vogue magazine, Thalia Karafilidou. It will be published under the umbrella of Katimarini Publications, the group responsible for the publication of Greek daily conservative newspaper Katimarini. Monocle's Daphne Karnazes caught up with Karafilidou here at Midori House recently to find out more.
So it's interesting, the background, because I'm not a journalist, not even a fashion expert. I'm a lawyer specializing in intellectual property law. For the last 10 years, I was communication director for several sectors. And now the new adventure is becoming the editor-in-chief of the new Vogue Greece, which is a great journey for me. And fingers crossed it will go as well as the previous journeys.
So I know that you've been quite careful to point out that this isn't a relaunch of Vogue Hélas, which was the previous incarnation of the magazine. It's a new title. You've given it a new title as well. What do you envision as being the most important differences, I guess, between Vogue Hélas and the new Vogue Greece?
Greece has changed dramatically for the last years. It was the economic crisis. Everybody has to redefine themselves, even the way they see luxury. So the new Vogue Greece, it's about intellectual luxury, not only about material things, but about true luxury. Free time is the new luxury. Being able to be offline is the new luxury. Spending time with amazing people is the kind of luxury that everybody wants now. Obviously, we want to purchase amazing bags and shoes, but it's something more nowadays. So I think that this is the differentiation point from the different previous Vogue Hélas to the new one.
And why do you think it's particularly good timing? Why is it the right moment now?
So the new Vogue Greece will be published under licensing agreement from Kathimerines Ekdosis, which is the oldest and the most wealthy and stable company in Greece. It's the publishing house that is producing the oldest and most prestigious newspaper. So even though it was very difficult for Greece for the last 10 years. Kathimerini was the company that actually invested in different projects, new projects, new launches, and it was very successful for them. So I think that it was the ideal time to have back a title that it was highly anticipated by many. And it's actually a magazine that it's totally different from all the other ones. So I think this new adventure will be our dream when coming true.
And just to clarify, it's going to be sold as a standalone, but also as a supplement within Kathimerini.
So it will be the first Vogue that it will be a supplement with Kathimerini newspaper at the last Sunday of every month. And then it will be at the kiosks in Greece and in Cyprus as well.
And can we go a bit more specifically into what we can expect from the content? I know that you mentioned luxury and this new way that you're defining luxury. Will it also be a platform for Greek brands and Greek designers? And, you know, we've heard a lot lately about this new sort of crop of young, enthusiastic Greek designers.
That's true. First of all, it's the fashion bible. So 60% of the magazine, it will be all about fashion. And Vogue always has an authoritative voice and will dictate how fashion should be and what all the main trends of the season. But it's very important for us to be whole person. So it's not only about fashion, it's about culture, travel, social matters that everybody cares about. So it's the glass ceiling, it's even burnout, social rights, gay rights. So everything that actually matters for all the people in Greece. For all the people worldwide. It will be an international magazine with a Greek twist, obviously, and it will be a multimedia brand and a Greek platform for the voices of all the Greek designers and talents to the world.
And are you personally quite excited about, you know, the new voices of Greek design and emerging designers? Have you seen a positive sort of trend lately?
It's amazing that the last years there are so many emerging Greek designers that actually they're very famous worldwide. We don't only have Mary Katranzou, who is the biggest name in fashion industry and she's Greek, but we have so many new designers that they stand from the crowd and make us all very proud. So that's why this Vogue, the new Vogue, it will be obviously internationally, but will be a platform for all the Greeks that they stand out from the crowd. So it's an exciting journey for all of us.
And can you reveal anything about the design and the look and feel of the magazine and how it will compare maybe to other Vogue titles around the world?
Obviously, it will be a totally new layout than the previous one. More minimalistic, a layout that it will be luxurious. And I'll give you a hint that the new modern version of Vogue, probably it will be possibly the same as the last one. So, yes.
And just broadening it out a bit, what's your view on the condition of the Greek publishing sector overall right now and the media sector?
So we truly believe that print is not dead, and that's why Kathimerini is investing in so many products, so many magazines and newspapers, and that's why it believes so much in Vogue Greece and coming back. It was not very easy for the last years for the publishing houses, and a lot of them actually closed down. But we're very lucky that we have a publishing house that is very wealthy, very strong, and deciding to take a lot of risks and investing in products that they really matter. And that's why Condé Nast chose Kathimerini to be their partner for this new and amazing magazine.
Are there any other Greek magazines or newspapers that you would pick out as being examples of the sort of thing that you think is strong journalism and strong content?
I truly believe that the new Vogue, it will be totally different from the other magazines because it's very upscaled for very intellectual people. And as I've told you, it's not just a fashion magazine, it's a way of living and a lifestyle. So I cannot compare it to all the other magazines because it's not on the same scale. But I truly respect the work of all the other magazines, but I believe that this is something totally different.
And just finally, what part of the upcoming role are you most excited about and what do you think might be the biggest challenge even?
The biggest challenge is to make a magazine that it will stand out not only in Greece, but internationally. The biggest bet that we have is for all the other Vogues and all the other magazines around the world to actually say that Vogue Greece is doing a fantastic job, and we actually want to be like them. So yes, this is the bet, and we will try very hard to succeed. So fingers crossed.
That was Talia Karafilidou in conversation with Monocle's own Daphne Karnazes here in London, talking about the return of Greek Vogue. Time now on the programme to go transatlantic. Let's cross to New York, a state that recently saw 29-year-old Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez elected to Congress. Self-identified democratic socialist, she's the most visible sign, perhaps, of a revived economic leftism in America. Jacobin is one of the leading journals of this movement, and Henry Reese Sheridan, late of this parish, recently paid a visit to their offices.
Socialism used to be one of the dirtiest words in American politics, but that's quickly changing. Before the election of President Trump, the Democratic Socialists of America, a non-party political group, had just 7,000 members nationwide. Today, it's got 55,000 and is still growing. Jacobin is a magazine which has led and documented the American socialist movement since 2010. It's handsomely designed and thoughtfully edited, and it's run with the kind of business acumen not normally associated with collectivism. I travelled to the magazine's headquarters in Brooklyn to meet Bhaskar Sankara, Jacobin's founding editor and publisher, and its creative director, Ramike Forbes.
My name is Bhaskar Sankara. I work for Jacobin. I live in New York.
My name is Ramike Forbes. I'm the creative director of Jacobin.
Jacobin is a socialist publication. It's meant to bring a type of democratic socialist politics, socialism that is resolutely anti-capitalist, to a broad audience. And it began in 2010. I was an undergraduate at George Washington University, and with a handful of writers and people around the Democratic Socialists of America and other organizations on the American left, we just decided to start a publication because there was nothing else to do. Jacobin became a print venture almost immediately, simply on the basis that there's plenty of online publications. If you want to differentiate yourself, you should enter a smaller marketplace, and print was a smaller marketplace. So if we were ignored when we were an online magazine, which is basically just a fancy name for a blog, among a million different online magazines, we were now a new print socialist US-based publication, of which there was only a half dozen potential competitors.
Some political magazines seem to revel in clunky design, but not Jacobin. It's got artful foldouts and a compact format, and actually feels more like a niche fashion or art publication than a conventional current affairs title. Ramike told me about Jacobin's relationship to historical socialist publications and how his thinking about it has developed from when he started.
I remember the time, like, you know, I would look back at kind of the history of the masses and, like, the new masses, which were these sort of early socialist publications in U.S. history in the early 20th century that were actually known for actually having a lot of illustration. They're actually quite well known for their art, and actually the masses itself was influential aesthetically and actually, a lot of what we kind of think of the New Yorker is sort of like how style of like illustration or cartoons actually comes out of that in many ways. And one thing I remember, like, you know, reading like some histories of both publications, and one thing that sort of surprised me is that many of the artists that they commissioned, people who they had like producing like artwork, were actually just like illustrators. They were, you know, people who did cartoons for did illustration for other newspapers and publications. And so, you know, really these magazines were just operating, they're left-wing publications, but they're operating really like any other magazine. And I think, you know, at the time, like, I remember, like, a few years ago, I think my mentality was like, oh, you know, that to produce, like, a left-wing publication, we need to find, like, every, like, revolutionary artist out there and bring them together and, like, produce this product. And then, you know, it kind of quickly dawned on me that that doesn't really make much sense, and that really we should be seeking out, like, the best illustrators we can find. And in the end, that would probably serve the goal of the magazine better. So, you know, I began to focus more on just, like, you know, just getting the best kind of quality we could get for the magazine. And in some ways, I think the fact that Jacobin has, like, a lot of this sort of, like, vector illustration is sort of, you know, there is, like, kind of a nice bridge to, like, those sort of earlier publications, which were, you know, usually done in, like, this kind of woodblock illustration. And, of course, the reason why they, you know, a lot of printmakers did this because it was, like, very cheap and, like, easy to do mass reproduction that way. And it made sense for that time. But, you know, it's sort of odd when I see, like leftists today trying to produce illustration that way. Really, I think the thing that's most in spirit with that sort of history, those sort of like publications, is to actually work with the kind of tools that we have today. So I think in some ways, like, our approach to illustration is very much more in spirit with that kind of artwork.
I think what Remike did was come up with a design that just broke with a lot of the conventions of the existing left, kind of the old hangovers from the 60s, like the, you know, the black and white kind of Students for a Democratic Society fonts, the old hammer and sickles and fists and kind of very activist-y look that kind of was just basically bad design, and he replaced it with something that was clean and also fit within our budget.
In September, Jacobin bought Tribune. It's a British socialist magazine with a glorious history, but a less than glorious balance sheet. Basker hopes to revive it. It's the latest addition to his expanding stable of titles, which includes an academic journal and also an Italian edition of Jacobin.
Tribune had fallen into disrepair. It wasn't publishing anymore. So we were approached and also encouraged by people within the Labour left and within the Labour Party to take on Tribune, or at least help revive it, and also to, you know, safeguard its archives and so on. And with our other efforts, like we have Jacobin Italia and a few other efforts, those are just franchises in the classic way of, these are countries that are relatively monolingual, or at least there's not a very large Anglophone population. So it makes sense to, franchise the Jacobin model and give some encouragement, some support, some basic operating guidelines, and, you know, run it that way.
Where do you see Jacobin in 3 years and 5 years' time, and how do you intend to get there?
Well, I think that the goal for Jacobin in the next 3 to 5 years is largely steady growth and consolidation. So I imagine Jacobin in 3 years at around 50,000 subscribers. I imagine us in 5 years, somewhere between 50 and 100,000 subscribers. But it depends on when. But it depends on what happens in the outside world and politics and so on. But if you create a stable institution, you can create something that'll be there for 40, 50, 60, 70 years. So I would say in 3 years, I think it should be comfortable for me and Remike to take vacations. Yeah, and 5 years, I think, ideally, if we're tragically killed in a, like, boating accident, and only one of us is found and the other one never appears again, but there might be a life insurance policy involved, I don't know what's going on, but then the magazine would go on, you know, fine.
For Monocle, in New York, I'm Henry Rees-Sheridan.
And that is all we have time for on this week's programme. Thanks, as always, to our producer, Fernando Gostopcheco, and our editors, Cassie Galpin and Sarah Miles. Comments or queries are welcome. You can send them now, or maybe wait till the new year. Either way, get in touch with Fernando on fp@monocle.com. Before we go, we have a song for you. One of the stars of the Pirelli calendar this year, Letizia Casta, was, in fact, in the video for this next song. Not sure? Chris Isaac with Baby Did a Bad, Bad Thing. This is The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. Thanks for listening. I didn't think so. You ever try with all your heart and soul to get your lover back to you? I wanna